This is program number 6 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton, here's your speaker. We have tried to demonstrate in this discussion that there is strong scientific evidence that there was a beginning. We have tried to point out that suggesting that that beginning was self-existing is inconsistent with the conservation laws of science. And we have tried to demonstrate that there are certain properties that the cause would have to have. Intelligence, purpose, design. And we have seen that on an intuitive level, on an architectural level, and on a mathematical level. What we want to turn our attention to now is what has to be the nature of that cause? What has to be the nature of whatever it was that created time, created space, created matter energy? It is interesting to me that when you talk to atheists about God, you almost inevitably find that their concept of God, what they think God is badly misguided. I've never really known an atheist who knew what God is, and I say that even though I was an atheist for the first part of my life. My whole family was made up of atheists. I was actively involved in atheist societies and organizations. I have never known an atheist who knew what is meant by the word God. I've never known an agnostic that had a working, functional, logical understanding of what we mean by this thing that we call God. And I've known very few Christians who really understand what we're talking about when we talk about this thing we call God. Let me ask you to think for a minute. When I say God, what comes into your mind? What do you visualize? Do you visualize anything? Do you see an old man in the sky with a long white beard, big white flowing robes? What's your understanding? What I would like to suggest to you is, in this discussion, that in order for the cause to have been able to do what it did, there are certain properties that cause has to have. And one of those properties is it has to be something from a different dimension, interacting with our dimension. And let me try to demonstrate this to you with a little story that I've always enjoyed that I think demonstrates this concept very, very well. The little story was written by a man with the name of Edwin Abbott, and it was written for the purposes I'm using it for in this discussion. Flatland is the story of a man who lives in a two-dimensional world. And what I mean by that is he lives in a world that's like a sheet of paper. A sheet of paper has only length and width. In the surface of the paper, at least, it has no thickness. And you have to understand that in our common everyday experience, there's a radical difference between the way we perceive things in three dimensions, X, Y, and Z, and what we see in two dimensions. You cannot get me, a three-dimensional being, into a two-dimensional sheet of paper. You can't do it. You can draw a front view of me, but there's lots of properties I have that will not show up in just a front view. A portrait doesn't tell you the whole story. You can draw a side view of me. We call that a profile. In the story of Flatland, the man in Flatland is shown as a profile. But a profile, again, does not tell you everything there is to know about me. It only shows a side view. You can draw a back view of me. You can draw a top view of me. By the way, I'm bald, so a top view is 4 concentric circles. You got that? You know, head, bald spot, shoulders, belly. But 4 circles isn't all there is to me. It's just the view of me from above me. You cannot get me, a three-dimensional being, into a two-dimensional sheet of paper. And in the story of Flatland, the man who lives in Flatland is visited one day by a sphere that can pass through Flatland. And now stay with me here, and I know this may sound a little wacky, but I think it will help you with some understandings, whether you're an atheist or whether you're a believer, that can be very useful. The man in Flatland is sitting in his living room, reading his newspaper one day, and a sphere crosses Flatland right in the living room of the person living in Flatland. So what happens in Flatland? Well, the first thing that happens is that a dot appears on his floor out of nothing. And he sees this dot just suddenly come into existence. Now understand something. In Flatland, a dot is matter. This man who lives in Flatland is made of a series of dots. That's what a line is. So the material of which he is made has come into existence out of nothing. And as he watches in amazement, the dot becomes a circle. See, what has happened is that the sphere has sunk deeper into flatland. If you took a tennis ball and touched a knife to the bottom of the tennis ball, you'd have a dot. But if you took the knife and cut a slice off of the tennis ball, the bottom of the ball wouldn't be a dot anymore. The bottom of the ball would be a circle. If you like to say things mathematically, when you truncate a sphere, what you get is a circle. So the sphere sinks deeper and deeper into flatland, and the circle gets larger and larger. And this blows the mind of the guy in flatland, because he's a scientist. And he knows that matter energy cannot be created out of nothing, but he has seen matter come into existence out of nothing, by no process that he can comprehend. Something has come from nothing. And let me just stop here and say, you've heard some books that have been written and some prominent figures in the science community who have said that they have proven that something can come from nothing. Well, this is exactly what they have done. And they have changed their definition of nothing so it does not include something moving from a higher dimension. So as the man watches, the circle gets larger and larger, and he gets scared at this point because this is getting closer to him. So he gets out of his chair and he starts moving towards the door. And you may have some difficulty visualizing how someone in a perfectly flat plane can move, but you can do it. Cartoons do it all the time. But then the sphere reaches its equator and passes its equator. So what happens to the size of the circle? And yeah, the answer's obvious, isn't it? It gets smaller because you're cutting the ball further from the equator. That's another violation of the laws of science. Matter energy is now being destroyed, and that can't happen. And there's no nuclear explosion. Everything he knows to be true scientifically is not working. And so he creeps back into the room watching this circle get smaller and smaller and smaller until finally it's just a dot once again. The sphere is now tangent to the plane from the bottom, and then it completely and totally disappears. Matter energy has been completely and totally destroyed. And that can't happen. Now, in this fictitious story, the man in flatland starts to talk to the sphere, and the sphere talks back. And by the way, that's an interesting situation, because when the sphere talks, the sound waves come up through flatland, so the voice comes from everywhere, even inside him. And if you're tracking this, I hope you can visualize that. But they talk. And the man in flatland says to the sphere, "Tell me, what is it like to be a sphere?" And the sphere thinks he knows how to do this, so he says to the man in flatland, "Here's what I want you to do. I want you to draw a circle on your floor." That's not easy. "Oh, it would be for you, because you're three-dimensional, and you can draw circles on a piece of paper really easily. But to the man who lives in flatland, a circle is a constantly curving line that comes back where it starts. And he's never seen a whole circle at one time. Because realize that when he looks at a circle, the side on his side, the side facing him, blocks the other side. The only way he could ever see a whole circle would be to be in the middle of it. And if he ever got in the middle of it, then he could look all directions and see the circle from the inside. But the problem with that is that if he did that, he couldn't get out of the circle. People in flatland commit suicide by drawing circles around themselves that they can't get out of." If you're having trouble with that, suppose you had a hollow steel ball that was a foot thick, and somehow you got in the middle of it. No windows, no doors. Could you ever get out of it? See, that's a three-dimensional demonstration of what I'm talking about. So the point is, it's dangerous for the man in flatland to draw the circle. It takes him hours. And the sphere says, "Whoa, what's the matter with you? I could do it instantly." But he's not in flatland. So finally the circle is drawn. And the sphere says, "Boy, I sure am glad you finally got that done. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to rotate the circle." See, what he's thinking is that the man in flatland can rotate the circle around its diameter. Around its diameter. So if you took a circle and you rotated it around its diameter, you would get a sphere, wouldn't you? Draw a line through the center of a circle and rotate it around the line. But what the man in flatland does is that he takes a hold of the circle and he spins it around its circumference instead of its diameter. It makes it spin like a top. And the sphere says, no, go the other way. So he stops it and spins it the other way. Instead of going clockwise, it goes counterclockwise. And the sphere says, no, go the third way. And the poor guy in flatland says, "You idiot, there is no third way." Because in flatland, there isn't, is there? Up and down means something different to the man in flatland than it does to the sphere. The sphere is talking up off the paper and down through the paper. The man in flatland is talking towards the top of the paper and towards the bottom of the paper. It is completely and totally impossible for the man in flatland to truly comprehend the real nature of the sphere. The only way, and listen to this statement very carefully, the only way the man in flatland can comprehend anything about the sphere is the way the sphere manifests itself in his own dimension. So how could you get something from nothing? What has to be the nature of the cause of the beginning? It has to be something that is outside the three-dimensional world in which we live. Now, there are some scientists who have suggested that the universe is made up of superstrings, 11th-dimensional quantities, this comes from mathematical equations, that could interact and produce matter in the three-dimensional world in which we live. There have been proposals about another kind of particle called the brain, B-R-A-N-E, again, a multidimensional particle. People talk about virtual universes, universes that exist in other dimensions. The realization is that in order for time to be created, in order for space to be created, in order for matter and energy to be created, the process has to be by something that is in a different dimension than the three-dimensional world in which we live. Now, you're likely in this situation to say, well, okay, that's an interesting little exercise, but that's so esoteric, I don't know what practical value it is. The fact of the matter is that we use this type of process, this kind of description, many, many times in science. Because there are many times when something we are describing does not lend itself to empirical observation through our senses. Do you realize, for example, that we've never seen an atom? Nobody has ever seen a single atom. We've never touched one, we've never tasted one, we've never smelled one. In no way have we perceived a single atom. We've never seen a single electron. Nobody's ever taken an electron, held it up, looked at it, smelled it, tasted, felt it, heard it in any way, perceived it through our senses. We've never seen a photon. Nobody's ever taken a particle of light and smelled it or tasted it. And yet in all these cases, we know these things are real. It's hard to ignore the atomic bomb. We all recognize the role of electrons. And light is pretty hard to deny. How do we do this? Well, let me take an example that you all know. Somewhere in your educational experience, probably about the third grade, you had a teacher who convinced you that there were such things as electrons. And what that teacher did was that teacher took a dead cat and rubbed it on a hard rubber rod and showed you that if you rub a dead cat on a hard rubber rod or on a comb, that the comb will pick up little bits of paper. Remember that? Yeah, third grade. In high school, you did the Dirac version of the Millikan oil drop experiment, and you proved that an electron has a mass that is 1,837 times smaller than the mass of a proton. When you took physics, the most wonderful class you ever took in high school, I say that because I teach it, you learned that electrons spin clockwise in the North magnetic field. And everything that we know about electrons that allows us to have television sets and computers and all the wonderful things that are part of our 21st century world, we have because we have understood electrons through their properties. When you have an entity that does not lend itself to empirical observation through your senses, the way you understand that entity is through its properties. And may I suggest to you that that same process is the process we use to understand the nature of God. Because you see, when God is described in the Bible, once again, we are describing an entity that does not lend itself to our senses, just like the electron doesn't, just like quarks don't. And especially when we start talking about things like superstrings and brains. And it's important to realize in this discussion that the Bible uniquely defines God in this very same way. We are told in the Bible that God is outside of time. A day is unto the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. 2 Peter 3 and verse 8, Psalms 90 and verse 4. The Bible is full of references to the fact that God exists outside of time, that He is the creator of time. We also are told in the Bible that God is outside of space. In Jeremiah 23, in verse 23 and 24, the writer says, "Do I not fill heaven and earth, saith the Lord?" The concept is that God is not limited to the three-dimensional world in which we live. In Acts 17, beginning with verse 22, Paul, in his writings, says that God is a God in whom we live and move and have our being. God is not an old man in the sky. When somebody asks what sex is God, when somebody asks what nationality is God, when somebody asks what race is God, when somebody wants to know how God can hear my prayer and the prayer of the little boy in China at the same time, all of those questions are rooted in a fundamental ignorance of the nature of God. God is outside of time. He is outside of space. The same thing can be said about superstrings. The question then becomes, can we put what we discussed in program number 5 with what we discussed here? If there is design, if there is intelligence, if there is purpose in the creation, then these descriptions that I just gave to you from the Bible fit well with the existence of design in the creation. On the other hand, if we're talking about superstrings, then the process is a process that depends uniquely upon chance. One of the other problems that involves here is that there have been those that have even questioned whether proposals such as superstrings and virtual universes are good science. The problem is that in superstrings, for example, there are over 500 equations that can be used to describe the conditions that lead to superstrings. And only one of them seems to be a possible fit. Can we somehow believe that such an astronomical number of equations could have a single, by chance, chosen variable? Of course, if you're an atheist, then your answer to that has to be, well, yes, but the problem is that does not account for the design features that we see in the cosmos. So the nature of the cause has to be something that is extra-dimensional. One of the interesting things about that is that our whole understanding of God and the way God functions is frequently rooted in a failure to understand the nature of God. It's important for us to realize that God fits all of the definitions that would come about by the definition of time and space. We now know from a scientific standpoint that time is not the same for everyone. Einstein has shown us that if we get the right kinds of velocities, that time changes. Time is relative to the observer. There's a famous equation that describes the relationship of time and velocity that says that time can change. If you get near the speed of light, then time slows down. It's a very simple equation. It's a very simple concept. But it says that time is not fixed. In 2 Peter 3, and verse 8, we read, "Beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing, that a day is unto the Lord as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day." What's that passage saying? It's saying that time is relative. That time is not the same for everybody in every situation. What's interesting is all of this work that Albert Einstein did for us and all of our understandings of this match well with the description of God and space. Because it's kind of important to realize that if time is unlimited, then this has very specific things to say about our relationship to space. Let's suppose we had a God that is outside of time. Every piece of time is now to God. What would that mean? It would mean that that God outside of time has all of eternity to listen to every last split-second prayer of a pilot as his plane goes down in flames. It means that God has the capacity to look at the past and the future at the same time. All of those passages, like "in him we live and move and have our being," all those passages that suggest that if God is outside of time, he has infinite access to space. We understand the nature of that. And let me give you one more illustration of this. Let's suppose I could turn you into God for a minute. Let's suppose I could put you outside of time, and let's suppose that the earth could function in its normal way. Think what you could do. You could go out and get in your automobile, and you could drive to Los Angeles, California, and you would be wherever you are now and in Los Angeles now, if I could stop time. You could get in your car and you could drive to Washington, D.C., and you would be where you are now, and in Los Angeles, and in Washington, D.C., and you'd be all three places now, if I could just stop time. Or you could go to the moon. You wouldn't have to breathe or eat or feel pressure if I could just stop time. You could be everywhere and all places now if I could just stop time. I've taken you through all these things to try and get you to understand that the nature of the cause, regardless of whether you think it's super strings or whether you think it is God, has to be an entity outside of space-time. And in our discussions of man's nature and the nature of the world in which we live, we're going to see more and more evidence that this is, in fact, the real description of the real world in which we live. So what we'd like to do here in our next program is to take this one step further and ask, well, then how do we fit into this? Because the Bible says, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he them, male and female created he them, and called their name Adam. What does that mean? Well, we'll look at that in the next program, and it will support the things we've tried to suggest to you as we've challenged you to think about the nature of the cause of the beginning.